This podcast was brought to you by Business Radio, powered by Wharton, originally airing on Sirius XM.
Welcome to our Behind the Markets podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz. Alongside Wharton Frank Professor Jeremy Siegel, we tackle the latest market trends every week on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM, Channel 132. Welcome to Behind the Markets here on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz, Global CIO at WisdomTree. My co-host is Wharton Finance Professor Jeremy Siegel, who's also a senior economist for WisdomTree. Please note, I'm a registered representative of Foreside Fund Services. Our discussion is not tied to the offer of any investment products. We're going to have a really interesting show. We're going to go deep on the oil and energy markets. We have a guest who's got a very interesting worldview on what's happening across all energy markets. But before we get to him, Professor, a lot of data. We got the employment report. We got some productivity numbers. We got and sort of a lot of moves in the markets. Curious to get your latest take.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you remember, Jeremy, a month ago when the January report came in, I said it was the craziest report he ever saw. I mean, like it was a record-busting number of new jobs, and then we had a plummeting in the number of hours, which is only like happens during, you know, really recessions. And I said, I don't really know what to make of it. Well, guess what? It almost all got revised away today. In today's report, they really lowered last month and they raised the hours. It did not plummet as much as they said it was going to plummet. It looks more normal. Now, I will grant that, you know, the cold January did depress a couple of those factors, but at least now my hunch that was looking a little crazy is assuaged at least. I think it's a good report. Now, when you get it, it's 150,000 jobs and it keeps on growing. That's a good report. Now, let me talk about some of the other, and by the way, the wages, of course, we're going to be looking at inflation, was right on the button. Actually, month over month, it was below expectation. Now, we've always warned, don't look at wages alone, because if productivity is up, wages can go up without any inflationary pressure. But at least that inflationary component, that's what we watch on the labor market report, was looking really very good. Let me just say, because we're still on in inflation, that next Tuesday's report on CPI is going to be very important, because I think there were quirks that brought January up on the OER, owner's equivalent rent, that might reverse, and we might actually get quite a good one. And this is going to influence, because it comes right at the time that the Fed is going to be, every 19 of the FOMC members are going to be doing their dot plots, submitting them. We will talk next week, because it will be the week after next, that on March 20th, when the next Fed meeting is, and we'll review it beforehand. So I don't want to get off on that. I do want to mention something that was interesting. I saw 3.9% unemployment, and then I saw a headline that's a two-year high. Woo. And I said, wait a minute, I remember 3.9% unemployment. And then I noticed that they revised, that we did have it, and it was reported about 6 months ago, and then it got revised down to 3.8. So this is, in a way, a high, although anything under 4% is still darn good, you know, in terms of unemployment. Now, is a headline two-year high on unemployment going to, you know, say, oh, my God, things are bad? I've always said I sort of think a 4.0% threshold, when you get into those fours, that will raise eyebrows. And if we get four, that would put pressure on Jay Powell to lower rates, as long as everything else is going good. What I also saw, though, is the U6, which, as you know, is the broader measure of unemployment, actually did go to a two-year high, and it's actually up almost a full percentage point from where it was last year. So that's gone up even more. It's because people are getting into the labor force, and looking for jobs because they hear there are jobs. They're not all finding them right away, so that unemployment goes up, but there are jobs and it is still getting hiring. I mean, the big trigger is if we ever get a negative monthly payroll, that would really be something. But again, those two things are watch. If they continue to rise, it puts more pressure on the on Jay Powell. I, by the way, thought his testimony was a little more dovish than I expected. He said he thinks he's, instead of emphasizing that January was troublesome, he said, I think we're close to a decision. Well, if we get a good CPI next Tuesday and PPI following it, along with the wage report we got today, I think that could be enough. Not for a March move. I don't think that's going to happen, although not 100% out of the question. But I think teeing up the following meeting, which I believe is a May meeting for the Fed. So it's a sort of a tee up more than anything else, and a discussion of that. By the way, I do expect, because of the strength of the economy, that actually the dot plot that comes out 2 weeks from now, and we'll discuss it again after CPI and everything comes out next Friday, is going to be more hawkish than what we saw last December. And that's because of the strength of the economy. It isn't because inflation is, you know, much worse than expected, because of the strong strength of the economy. I mean, it's jobless claims, you know, right in that center point, remained exactly 217. We love it. I mean, right in the center. I should mention, a couple have asked me about gold breaking its high, or it did nothing for 4 years. And now it has momentum. There's a lot of momentum. I mean, listen, there's momentum players in gold now. There's momentum players in Bitcoin. There's momentum players in NVIDIA and perhaps some of the other stocks. It's the very beginning. Now, the big $64 question, which no one has an answer to, are we in 1996-97, where these stocks are going to get as crazy as those stocks got 24 years ago? And there's no real answer to that. You know, we discussed this before. If NVIDIA gets where Cisco was in 2000, it's a $3,000 stock. And I'm not saying that's my prediction. I'm just saying, because that was crazy back then. I'm just saying how far emotions can go. We got more. We're beginning to get trend followers, momentum players moving into that market. Again, overall, we got a PE of 21 on the S&P. The growth sector's 30. You know, the value sector's 16. Big gap, but it has been bigger and was bigger, certainly, during that dot-com bubble. What I like is the broadening to small caps. That's really good, and that's because they're going to benefit. And, you know, the idea of a soft landing or no recession just keeps on going up, up, up. I mean, we've said that for a long time, but it's creeping in, and then the small caps should definitely benefit there. That we know there's an infusion in New York Community Bank. I'm not going to make a big deal out of that. I still don't think that is a systemic thing that is going to blow up into the market and cause any big problems.
Yeah, it's going to get you to comment on the overall valuations, Professor. There's been some comments about where are you in that 99 versus today, so I'm glad you commented on that. The 10-year looks exactly where you've said, sort of the 4% range is where you've seen it going over the long run. It keeps huddling here right around, you know, now below 410, but this is sort of your long-run view of where the 10-year should be?
Yeah, my long-run for Fed funds is 3.5. That's a whole percentage point above the Fed's long-run, which, you know, you'll see when the dot plot comes out in 2 weeks. Theirs is 2.5% because they think the R star is a half and they add the 2% inflation. I think the R star is 1.5 and it might even be a little higher. So I'm actually thinking Fed funds of 3.5, maybe up to 4 as the long run, and the 10-year at 4 to 4.5, which is exactly, as you say, where it is bouncing now, and the tips between 1.5 and 2, where it is. Now, listen, this doesn't mean that range. It's going to be moving out of that range, and the economy gets stronger. If AI gets stronger, productivity gets stronger, we're going to move positively, you know, from on these real rates. At least this is the range I see with my current projections on economic variables.
Any quick comments on State of the Union address last night? Anything you heard, didn't hear, that you'd like to comment on?
He didn't fall off the platform, which I think the Democrats are heaving a sigh of relief. Got down, hugged people. It was feisty. I think the Dems are happy. Very honestly, it's 8 months, and there's, maybe he's ready. There's going to be an awful lot going on. Is he going to debate? Was he going to make any other stumbles? I think a lot of people were overemphasizing a good performance, and I would say it was a good performance, certainly relative to expectations. What that really means down the road in November, 8 months, a lot of things can happen to Trump, and a lot of things can happen to Biden, and probably things will happen to both of them, and then the voters will make up their mind.
All right, well, Professor, thanks for giving us some comments to start the show. Have a great weekend.
Thank you very much. See you next week.
All right, I'm going to turn my conversation to my guest for the hour. We have Art Berman, who is, I think, one of the most interesting commentators and geologists in the energy space. I follow his blog, artberman.com. He's a consultant to the industry, produces a lot of very interesting comments. Art, welcome to Behind the Markets.
Thanks, Jeremy. It's good to be here.
So I think when I first reached out, it was right after a big debate between some of the notable energy followers. There's an anonymous group called Doomberg that produces some commentary, and you just sort of took them on a little bit and called them out. They were writing a bit about sort of this energy abundant thesis, and you commented in a post that all their cards have collapsed, that oil production is going to peak and decline. If you give, you've written a lot of interesting pieces. So we'll follow up on a lot of them, but from a high level view of where we are in sort of the energy markets today, maybe what's your big picture view, and what maybe where did this sort of energy abundant thesis go wrong?
The energy market overall is suffering and will continue to suffer from what my friend Nate Higgins calls energy blindness. And energy blindness means that most people and most investors really don't know very much about energy. And that's not a criticism. It's just an objective observation. So most people, if you ask them where energy comes from, they say, well, it comes out of the wall, of course. I plug in right here and I get power. You talk to politicians, and they've got some talking points about, we either like fossil fuels or we don't like fossil fuels, but renewables are coming along. And, one way or another, everything's going to be great. But the honest truth is that energy is a very unrepresented or underrepresented sector, say, in the S&P 500. It's I don't know what it is today, but, it's somewhere between 2-3%. You probably know better than I do, but it's very underrepresented relative to its importance to the overall economy. And so I mentioned this, and I could, go into a lot more detail, but I won't for right now, because there really just isn't the kind of momentum, that Professor Siegel was talking about in the energy space, that we have, investors have been fleeing from oil and gas now for, since 2018. There's periodic enthusiasm about renewables, although that's an on again, off again kind of thing. And I think we're more off than on right now. And again, I just think that there is a general energy blindness that people don't understand that energy is the economy. And as goes energy, so goes everything else that you and Professor Siegel talk about, that, we're talking about up, up, and up and momentum and all of that. Well, I got bad news for you, or for someone, maybe not you or him, but if energy, if oil in particular, is going to flatten out or decline slowly, which I think it will, then that is going to create an awful lot of slowing factors to this momentum that's going to ripple through the entire economy. So I think that we are, contrary to what Doomberg thinks, we are in a period of relative energy scarcity. And we have been in a period of relative energy scarcity since about 2017, 2018. That doesn't mean we're running out of it. It doesn't really mean that when you plug something into the wall, you won't get power. What it means is that we have a very close balance between our supply and demand of all sorts of energy, and that is going to tend to keep prices high, which they are now, and moving gradually higher. That's, you know, not considering kind of exogenous factors like geopolitics and things like that, which could spike it much higher or much lower. So the answer to your question is everything depends on energy. We can talk more about that. I think that cost of energy is going to become increasingly higher, and that is going to have a negative effect on everybody's discretionary income, and it's going to slow down the economy.
Yeah, this is definitely one of those political hot button issues in all parts of the world. Just a quick comment on your point of where it was in the S&P 500. It got down to exactly where you said, but it did have some good performance 2 years ago. So it's right under 4%. It's at 3.7% is where we are in the S&P 500. You have value investors, Warren Buffett, buying a lot of Occidental as one of his comments. He just wrote in his annual shareholder letter about all the needs for energy and really, I think, outlining a thesis that agrees largely with what Art is talking about here, why he's buying oil as one of his big natural resources and value stocks that he's doing. But sort of interesting commentary there. So Art, there's, I guess, this sort of scarcity dynamic, the tightness in energy, but, you know, there, I guess maybe one spot where we have a glut, and you've been writing some pieces on natural gas and sort of the excess production in natural gas. Maybe any comments on where natural gas diverges from the traditional sort of other parts of the energy part?
It doesn't, Jeremy. And I just posted a couple of hours ago on precisely that topic. And so what's going on in natural gas is the same thing that was going on in crude oil a couple of years ago, which is to say that the companies that are producing this stuff, I mean, they need to go back to, you know, to Wharton if they ever went. They need to learn to be adults about business. These guys, and, you know, I'm not specifying any, nor am I implying that they're not intelligent, but it's, you know, they're going to grow and grow and grow production until price or investors slam them and tell them stop. They don't know about restraint and discipline. And so what's happening in natural gas is there's nothing confusing, there's nothing complicated about it. These guys have produced their asses off. We are overproducing natural gas in the United States to the tune of 15 billion cubic feet a year, okay, a day per year. All right, so our total consumption is, let's just say round numbers, around, you know, 80. And so we are overproducing by something like almost 20%. So what do you think the price is going to do?
About
energy. You don't need to know anything about, you know, oil or natural gas. I mean, if you're overproducing something by 20%, the price is going to be low. And then you add to that the fact that we've now had two very mild winters in succession in the United States. So demand has been off. Put those together, and you got down to, you know, like $1.56 per million British thermal units a couple of weeks ago. It's come back to about $1.80, but, you know, it's way under its economic value, and there's only one place to look for why that is the case, and it's the producers. And again, that's not meant as a criticism. I mean, I am kind of criticizing. I mean, what kind of, you know, what kind of business are you guys running here where you're, you know, you're running yourselves into the ground? But that's the reason why there's this kind of mania about exporting liquefied natural gas. And when Biden, you know, a month or so ago, so yeah, I think we need to take a look at this. I mean, everybody freaked out. Like, what? How can you do that? I mean, that, you know, this is so important. Yeah, it's important because if we don't let those guys export their natural gas, the price of gas is going to go to zero.
Or negative, like they had with the...
Okay, so, I mean, you know, I don't know what Biden's reasons were for doing that pause. I think they were probably largely political more than anything else, because I suspect he's fairly energy blind himself, probably not as much as Thunberg, but, you know, but close. I mean, it's not his field. So, you know, give him a break. But so, I mean, he was doing it to get some support from the climate people in his party. But the honest truth is, yeah, we ought to look at this. I mean, I'm a free market guy, and I don't necessarily think that, you know, we ought to put a bunch of regulations on energy exports, but every once in a while we ought to look at it, because as I've written before, I mean, we're draining America first. We're using up our increasingly scarce crude oil and natural gas resources, which ultimately are kind of, you know, that's the treasury of the people. And we're letting these companies export as much as they feel like. I mean, we're exporting 4 million barrels of crude oil a day. I mean, that's, you know, that's the production of a lot of big countries, or the consumption of a lot of big countries. People yell and scream when Biden, you know, decided to use a little bit of strategic petroleum reserve to keep inflation down. It's a drop in the bucket compared to how much we export every day. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of inconsistencies, a lot of things most people don't really understand. And frankly, you know, I don't really expect them to understand. But that's, so the story on natural gas is we got a bunch of producers that just need to get, you know, they need to put their pants back on. It's what they need to do.
So get more capital discipline. It's interesting on how Europe plays into this. You mentioned they're producing it way below, it's at a price way below the economic value. How do you think about what that economic value is on natural gas if they weren't overproducing? Where do you think it would be? And then how does Europe come into the equation? I mean, they were sort of bailed out from maybe their winter, and they got into these also over storage versus where people thought they could be because of the war and their reliance on Russian natural gas. How's that all come together?
Well, I mean, the United States didn't save them. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know where that narrative comes from, because, I mean, when they stopped getting Russian gas, and I think it's a toss up whether they chose not to or whether they got cut off or maybe a little bit of both. But there was an element of choice in that matter, which was political, I think, more than anything else. But okay, so you get cut off from the primary supply of natural gas, and the United States says, oh, hey, we've got a lot of gas here. We can send it to you. Well, what's the time lag between us saying we got some and them saying we want it and them being able to use it? I mean, they have to build giant expensive terminals that can regasify the liquid gas. I mean, it's not just like, okay, here comes a boat and we'll just connect it to a pipeline. I mean, this stuff is under high pressure. It's a liquid. It's, you know, it's sub-zero temperatures. I mean, it's a very sophisticated industrial facility that has to get built. They didn't have any. I mean, they did in Spain and a few other places, but say Germany, zip. They had no capacity to receive LNG. So Europe got saved because they had a mild winter. End of story. That was last winter, winter of 22-23. U.S. LNG played absolutely no role whatsoever. Okay, since then, LNG has, liquefied natural gas, has been coming into Europe as they spent a ton of money for that oversupply. I mean, you know, they were You know, they were paying through the nose for any natural gas they can get. And oh, by the way, the governments of Germany and France and the UK are, you know, I mean, the social welfare that's going to consumers to allow them to afford energy would absolutely freak out even progressive Americans. So, this has all come at a huge cost to Europe because they were literally caught with their pants down. I don't know why. I mean, it's an absolutely foreseeable situation. That's the subject of another conversation. But the bottom line on all this is, yes, the U.S. has a fair amount of natural gas to export. Yes, a fair amount of it is going to Europe right now. It's not a substantial portion of Europe's consumption. It's growing. But, Europe's a big place, and they consume a lot of gas.
Let's talk a little bit about how the extra supply from the world has come from the U.S. and what the trends are that you're talking about, sort of this general scarcity trend. As you think about the big additional supply that we got out of the U.S., what is the big picture for people who don't follow it as closely as you? You know, what's the big story on all the extra supply and that sort of trend going forward?
Well, the big story on all the extra supply is that back 20 years ago, the world, the market of the world, didn't know where the next barrel of oil was going to come from. That we were on a global production plateau. That between about 2004 and 2011, 2012, no matter how many new fields were discovered, the amount of output was flat, because by the time we got new fields connected and on pipelines, old fields had depleted. And so we were just going nowhere. And yet demand was increasing because the population was going up. This was the period of peak oil. Okay. And the concern was very, very real. Demand's going up, supply is flat. That says we're going to be in trouble. And then the shale plays, so-called shale plays, tight oil in the United States came along. They came along for one reason, high price, because they're expensive. And they were successful, and they added about 4 million barrels a day to the global supply. And we can talk about the difference in crude quality and et cetera. We won't worry about that right now. 4 million barrels on top of, say, 100 million barrels. It's only 4%, but it's huge in the supply-demand equation. And so that extra supply caused prices to crater at the end of 2014. Market said, okay, we're convinced this is real. Therefore, we're going to discount the price of oil. And price of oil went from over $100 to, you know, to $65 or something like that, and stayed low for quite a while. Where we are right now is this shale oil or tight oil. It's you drill it and complete it differently than regular conventional oil. But once you start producing it, it's just like any other oil. All fields peak and decline. And these fields are, most of them are already in decline. The Permian has not yet peaked. It's close. It's flattening out. So we're getting to the point where these discoveries that were new 15 years ago are mature now, and they're going to decline. And the data is absolutely supports that. Okay, now people, the sales pitch on these things was, oh, this is unconventional. It'll last forever. Well, I wish it were true, but no. Like I said, these are oil fields just like any other. So the prognosis for the future is that all of these tight oil fields, except for the Permian, are already in decline. And the Permian, the data that I have, and I posted, it's all publicly available, it's free, whole website's free, it's going to decline. I mean, I can't tell you it's going to start to decline, you know, this year, next year, pretty soon, before the end of the decade, for sure. And before it declines, of course, it'll flatten, and then we're going to get back to where we were 20 years ago, which is to say the world doesn't know where its next barrel is going to come from. And that means only one thing, and that's the price goes up. So that's the simple answer to your question.
You wrote a piece about the Bakken break-even prices, and sort of in the opening talks about break-evens have risen 70% from some of their previous levels. As you think about what is the break-even, I mean, I'm sure every place has a different number, but how do you think generally about where it is, what gets them to do more, and are there technologies that can bring things, productivity even higher?
No. The technology fantasy is just that. It's a fantasy. Okay. And so let me qualify that, because I know there are going to be people right now freaking out. But I mean, this is part of the progress narrative that we Americans believe. We have more faith in the progress narrative than we do in God. Okay. That somebody's going to figure something out. That this is our the altar that we worship at is technology. All right. Now, if you look at any measure of productivity, technology, efficiency, productivity, they're all the same thing. Okay. And if you look at the U.S. economy, for instance, okay, you again probably know more than I do about this, but productivity has gone nowhere in this economy since the 1990s. Okay. We had a bump from computers and the internet, you know, back to the, you know, to the dot-com boom that the professor was talking about a little bit ago. And then it went down, and productivity really hasn't gone anywhere. I mean, there's a whole literature on the productivity paradox. We look at oil, and we talk and we hear, oh, I mean, these guys are geniuses. I mean, you know, look at the efficiency gains. Well, it's not true. I mean, if you look at any measure you want, but if you look at total factor productivity, oil industry productivity peaked in about 2007, and it's gone down ever since. Okay, so they've produced a lot of oil, but it costs them a lot. We add the inputs to the outputs, and the productivity is declining. So my take is that technology, I mean, humans are ingenious and innovative, and we figure out how to do things better, hopefully, by doing them over and over again. And if you look in my business, in the energy business, at how that efficiency or productivity moves year to year, it increases about 1% a year. Now, if I give you 1% a year on any investment, you're going to say, well, what else you got? I mean, I'll take your 1%, but I'm not making a big bet on 1% a year. I need something else. I mean, 1% doesn't even cover my risk. So I like to consider that technology and innovation they're like stowaways on a giant ocean liner who think that they control the journey because they're unaware, completely unaware, energy blind of the gigantic diesel engines underneath their feet that are actually driving the boat forward. So it is the crude oil, the coal, the natural gas, and to a lesser extent, the renewables that run the economy, and technology and innovation and efficiency and productivity are sort of like a little icing on top of the cake. They're sweet. They make the cake look good, but they're only, you know, 1% of the cake. So no, I don't think technology is going to save us from energy scarcity, nor do I think that technology is going to find a way out of our climate change and planetary ecological crisis or much of anything else. Again, I'm a believer in technology. I mean, I've got two computers in front of me and a giant screen and all sorts of gizmos and equipment all around me. I mean, technology is great, but let's not make it any more than that it deserves to be. It's a tool. It's an add-on, but it's the raw materials that run the world, and those are they mostly oil.
So in the second half, I definitely want to focus a bit more on the renewable story. But just to wrap up maybe this first part of the conversation, so you talk a little bit about the over-drilling, or maybe the over-drilling, the additional rigs that have helped support the production in the Bakken, where you talk about sort of the recovery rates having declined a bit, but they're still producing, and you're getting this good production because they're just over-drilling. Is that the main thesis?
They're drilling the wells too close together, okay? So, and this is not just true in the Bakken. It's true in the Permian. It's true in the Eagle Ford. It's a disease of all of the oil producers that, you know, somebody, some engineer comes along and does a study and said, hey, you know, I think we can move the spacing of these wells twice as close and still get the same amount of oil. And that looks really good in your investor presentation, in your earnings calls, in your conference calls, because you can say, hey, you know, last time I talked to you guys, we thought we had 5,000 locations in the Permian. Now we got 10. And everybody goes, yay, 10,000 locations. You know, you can be doing this forever. The problem is you drill the wells too close together and they cannibalize each other's production. And so each of the two wells you drill too close together produces less in its lifetime. Does it still make money? Maybe, maybe not. But it makes less money than it would if you just kept your pants on and only drilled one well. And so the literature, the engineering literature, is quite clear that you want to keep your wells something like, you know, the horizontal wells, you want to keep them something like 700 to 1,000 feet apart. Well, in a lot of these plays, they're 100 or 200 feet apart. So surprise, the wells are not performing as well as they did when the wells were spaced where they should be. It's very simple. It's just like the natural gas story. You know, manage your business intelligently and everybody will come out fine, at least until these things start to decline. But if you get too ambitious and you over-drill, then everybody loses. It costs more and we don't make as much. So that's where we're at. And again, it's not just the Bakken, it's all of these plays.
Very interesting. So I want to talk a little bit about renewables. And one of the titles of your piece, which was, I'd say, aggressive call out, but the title was "The Energy Transition is Being Led by a Clown Car." So we've got a bunch of politicians, energy blind politicians, as you talk about it. But where is this group, I guess, the most off base here? What when you think about the energy transition, the policies that we're exploring, where are we going really wrong?
Yeah, so, you know, let me count the ways. First of all, let me say I 100% support renewable energy. I think fossil fuels are terrible for not just the climate, but for, you know, the planet in general. So, I mean, I'm a scientist here. It's true that I've worked in the oil business, but, I mean, I have clients in wind and, you know, solar. I mean, I'm agnostic when it comes to energy. So where we're getting things wrong with renewables is that renewables are only good for one thing, and that's electric power. And electric power is less than 20% of world energy consumption. So, I mean, you know, back when you were at Wharton, I mean, they taught you things about how as a manager, you have to prioritize your tasks into A, B, and C and do the A tasks first, except that most managers do the C tasks first because they're easy. Well, electric power is a C task, okay? It feels good because you get something done, but you still haven't approached the B or the A because those are hard and those are the things that you really need to focus on. So let's just say that tomorrow we suddenly have 100% of our electric power provided by wind and solar. Okay, awesome. Great. What are you going to do about the other 80%? And somebody on the other side will say, yeah, but coal provides an awful lot of that electric power, and coal is the biggest culprit when it comes to climate change, and that's 100% true. So, you know, on the one hand, we do need to do something about coal, and most of that will be in electric power. But here's the problem, Jeremy. There are four pillars that hold up modern civilization, and every one of them has to have fossil fuels to stand. They are steel, concrete, plastic, and fertilizer. Okay, modern civilization will absolutely collapse if we don't have those four pillars, and we have absolutely no way to mine and smelt steel, much less transport it, make concrete, make plastic or fertilizer without oil, coal, and natural gas. Can't do it. Technically, maybe in the future, but we're talking decades and decades. So in order to be able to provide at scale what we need, we are 100% tethered to fossil fuels unless we want our civilization to collapse, which is an option, okay?
Nope.
And the planet will be much better for it, but humans will not be. So when, you know, when people say, oh, let's just get off of oil, you know, let's get on renewables. Okay, great. You're not going to have any steel. You're not going to have any concrete. So construction dies. No construction. You can't build anything. Plastic. The only place you get plastic from is natural gas and oil. Okay. Plastic is a key component of every renewable car, along with steel. Those are the two major components of every electric vehicle. Okay. Fertilizer. We make it mostly from natural gas. Okay, without fertilizer, the population of the planet goes back to where it was at the end of World War I, which is 2 billion people. Okay, so if we don't have fertilizer, only 6 billion of us need to die of starvation. Okay, so now these are, I'm not exaggerating, by the way. I mean, you know, we don't want to talk about any of this stuff because it's really ugly. It really is ugly. We will collapse our civilization on renewable energy. We will have so much civil strife, war, chaos, immigration. I mean, you think we got a border problem right now? Wait until we have billions of people who don't have enough to eat. Now, you know, again, I'm not being critical of renewable energy. It has a place, but it cannot power this civilization, not even close.
So is this part of this ESG tendencies to focus on these things and the energy transition? Is that part of the problem of the policies towards fossil fuels? Like where, when you think about the where the politicians need to reverse course, if they're trying to address these issues more realistically?
They won't. They won't, they can't, and they won't. Okay, we've had 36 international climate conferences over the last 40 years, and carbon emissions just keep going up and up and up. Okay. There's been zero effect. If climate change is the number one motive behind all this, we're batting zero. Okay. And so all of these policies and the trillions of dollars that are being, have been spent and are being spent are producing zero results. Okay. So, you know, from a cost benefit analysis, The climate change experts or skeptics who say it's not worth it, they're not wrong, so far at least. And so you have to have an awful lot of faith in something that is going to happen, you know, then a miracle happens that hasn't happened yet. So what's the answer? The answer is that we need to radically reduce our consumption of all energy. That will solve climate change problem, that will solve the ecological problem. We're poisoning our planet, we are extinguishing species, we're reducing the population of species that aren't going extinct. I mean, we have a huge problem that we don't want to talk about because it doesn't yet affect us. But without an ecology in good shape, I mean, that is the source of our of human prosperity and wealth. And we are poisoning that well faster than most people want to think about it. So The answer is we need to reduce our energy consumption. We don't need to figure out clever ways of replacing one form of energy with another, because that doesn't solve the problem. That keeps the human enterprise growing and growing and growing, and that ends up just causing more and more problems for the planet. So that's the problem, that the politicians and the people, they want to keep life going on as it is, and they don't want to have to change their behavior. And you can't have it both ways. I mean, and so this is a very troubling and challenging problem, psychological problem, to even acknowledge, much less deal with.
So some people talked about wind and solar, nuclear is one of the topics that people bring up as what we're not doing enough of that. Is that, in your view, at all part of the solution?
I get really annoyed with this. I mean, nuclear is like, you know, it's like this post-hypnotic suggestion. It's the Manchurian candidate, you know, like whenever you say, well, nuclear is really not a very good answer, people freak out. I mean, I can't tell you the kind of, I mean, if I want to get a whole bunch of views on Twitter, all I have to say is, you know, nuclear is not the answer. Holy cow. I mean, my Twitter feed explodes. I mean, I get hundreds of thousands of views because this is the progress narrative. This is this inextinguishable belief in technology. This comes from, you know, way back in the 50s that atomic energy is too cheap to meter. We can't accept that there isn't a technological fix. Okay. Simple answer to nuclear. If money were no problem, if permitting were no problem, if nuclear waste were no problem, if the public hates nuclear is no problem, if all we had to do was go, we cannot build enough nuclear power plants of any kind, small modular, giant, you know, giant plants. We cannot scale nuclear fast enough to move the needle even a little bit. And I've written posts on it. I don't like that answer myself. I would like there to be an answer. Nuclear ain't it. Sorry, guys. It's just, you can't get there from here. And people just refuse to. Does that mean we should stop nuclear? No, absolutely not. Nuclear is important. Okay, now, you know, there are waste, you know, nuclear waste is a problem and human error is a problem. Nuclear is dangerous stuff, don't get me wrong. But I'm just taking all that off the table. I'm just looking at this purely objectively. We cannot get there from here with nuclear. It just takes too long. And that's if I take away all the permitting problems and all the money problems and everything else. So just, you know, forget about nuclear. Don't forget about it. Just don't count on it. And the same is true for renewables. You know, I mean, they're definitely cleaner than fossil fuels. We just can't get there from here. We can't run this civilization on electric power. It just doesn't work. I wish it did, but it doesn't. So if we continue with the clown car, and we will, then what's going to happen is that carbon emissions keep going up. We keep overshooting our planetary boundaries, and eventually nature will do what nature always does. Okay, you guys are done here. You're done with this orgy. Either because the price goes up or the supply goes down or both or more, or we have wars or, you know, I mean, you name it, civil, you know, all sorts of, you know, the economy collapses. One way or another, we're going to reduce our use of energy, and it's not going to be pretty. It's going to be traumatic. And that's because we've chosen to not be honest about what the predicament that we're in is.
Is there a country or region doing this better? Any policies that are better? Is Europe learning from some of their issues with Russia? Is anything positive in this sort of clown car dynamic?
Well, it'd be great if they had a bunch of oil and gas to develop, but they don't. No, Europe is screwed. I mean, you know, I mean, I hate to say it as bluntly as that, but there are, sure, and, you know, somebody's going to find a country. You know, I mean, I think it's Paraguay or Uruguay. I can't remember which one, but you know, I think it's Uruguay. Is, you know, 85% of all their power comes from renewables, and they say, see, Uruguay can do it. I mean, everybody can do it. Well, you know, Uruguay has a population of, I don't know, what, 1.5 million people. It's got a huge amount of hydro. It's got, you know, giant rivers with very few people. It's got offshore. I mean, it's a very special case. And so, yes, the answer to your question is there are certain countries that are doing Norway. You know, Norway's got a ton of oil money that they use to subsidize people to buy electric cars. But guess what? Their oil and gas consumption isn't going down. It keeps going up. So in other words, people are driving EVs more, but they're using oil and gas for other things. So we just, my point is, I don't want to be negative and I don't want to, you know, depress people. But whenever you have a problem, you know, if you don't have enough money for your family to, you know, to get by, you've got to look at it very honestly. You got to say, we're going to have to do something, guys, and it's not going to be comfortable. We're going to have to find a serious area to cut. And as a society, we just are unwilling to do that. And that's what we need to do. We need to get honest about the energy predicament that we're in and stop thinking around the margins, you know, rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, because all that's going to do is continue the status quo. And eventually, as I said, nature is going to impose austerity upon us.
Well, I appreciate
it. And civilization is not going to collapse, I don't think. And the human species is not going to go extinct. Okay, I'm not one of those kind of guys. But it's going to be really hard. It's going to be really, really tough when it happens.
In 30 seconds, for people who want to find more about what you do, how you could help them as from your consulting business, where can they find you? Who should be reaching out?
ArtBerman.com. As I said, everything out there is free. You can contact me through there. If you want to, hear my daily brain farts, I'm on Twitter at AEBerman12. I'm on Substack. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook. So I'm easily found. Just Google me, Art Berman.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Behind the Markets here. It's been a great conversation. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with our listeners. Chris in the sound studio, thank you for helping. You can listen to us on our Behind the Markets podcast. Have a great week, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Behind the Markets podcast. If you want to learn more about WisdomTree, visit wisdomtree.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Jeremy D. Schwartz. I'd like to thank Patty Hall for producing our live program on SiriusXM Channel 132 and our podcast producer, Daniel Bruno. Join us next week for another edition of the show.
For more insight from Business Radio, please visit businessradio.wharton.upenn.edu.